Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to schools to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
And so the European debt crisis has come to this. Brazil is going to help in the bailout. What the developing countries can do that the rest of us can't. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Wednesday, today the 14th of September. Glad, as always, to have you with us. As of the latest on the foreign exchange markets today, 8 billion euros works out to about $11 billion American. That's how much the Greek government's due to get from the European Union bailout fund come the end of the month. It'll keep Athens solvent and, the theory goes, keep Europe from a Lehman Brothers-like crisis. Tonight, Germany's Angela Merkel and French President Nicolas Sarkozy got off a conference call with George Papandreou, he's the Prime Minister of Greece, and said Greece remains an integral part of the Eurozone. U.S. Treasury Secretary Timothy Geithner said this morning on CNBC there's not a chance the EU is going to let the Greeks default. So we asked Marketplace's Stephen Beard to follow up on our story from yesterday and help explain why a tiny little country in a far-off corner of southeastern Europe is so important to the rest of us.
This is not one, but three crises intertwined, and each of them could affect the U.S. First, there's the crisis over sovereign debt. If the Greeks default, it'll be the first time for a developed country in 60 years. Gabriel Stein of Lombard Street Research says that would raise doubts about other governments' finances.
The Greek default will prompt the possibility and likelihood of a Portuguese default and perhaps even Spanish default and concerns about Italy.
And he says eventually that could raise further concerns about US creditworthiness.
Greece is the canary in the gold mine, if you want. It's the warning signal that even countries like the United States, a massively rich country, cannot simply pile on debt and expect that nobody will ever get worried about it.
So far, foreign investors have not lost their appetite for US government debt, but Stein says that appetite could wane. And then there's crisis number two. A Greek default could force Greece out of the Eurozone and plunge the world's second most important currency into turmoil. Dominic Swords of the Henley School for Business says that could spark another crisis.
Another round of lack of confidence, reduction in investment, and slow growth.
The third euro crisis poses the biggest threat to the US. European banks are stuffed with Eurozone government bonds. They'll suffer big losses if Greece and others default. The banks will cut their lending. Tim Leunig of the London School of Economics says the result will be recession.
Certainly in Europe, with knock-on effects to the rest of the world, which, given that the US is spluttering at the moment, would be problematic in the United States.
The three Eurozone crises combined could hit the US hard. Indeed, some observers say it could be Europe's answer to the collapse of Lehman Brothers, with this time the shock waves travelling westward across the Atlantic. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Interestingly enough, not all the rescue talk is coming from Washington and the grand capitals of Europe. Some of the bigger developing countries, Brazil, India, and China in particular, the better part of the BRIC countries as they're known, are talking about whether they might be able to help prop things up as well. Reardon Rowett is with the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins University. Good to have you with us.
Thanks so much.
I wonder what a better phrase might be to explain what's going on with these developing economies. Is it ironic or a curious twist of economic fate that they're now thinking about helping the Europeans?
I think it's the arrival of the BRICS. They are not global powers, but they do have far more reserves than any of the countries in southern Europe first. Second, there's been a great deal of skepticism about whether or not the BRICS could act together. This is going to be an interesting test. The Indians seem a little more skeptical than the Brazilians and the Chinese.
Well, do the BRICS have the commonality of interest? Do they all want the same thing out of helping the European?
They do not want economic chaos. They do not want instability. And I think they have now come very recently to the understanding that Europe can't govern itself. The United States is paralyzed in terms of fiscal policy. They are the only countries that might be able to make a contribution. Important to say, they do not think, and I do not think, they are going to resolve this issue. What this is, I think, is a combination of symbolics, that is, we have arrived, we are the countries with the surpluses, and a commitment either to work as the BRICS or to work within the G20, which was brought back to life in 2008-2009, to move forward with further changes in the financial architecture, greater voting rights at the IMF, those kinds of things.
Yeah. This is an entirely subjective question, but do you suppose there's a bit of schadenfreude going on here among the Brazilians and the Chinese and the Indians?
No question about it. No question about it. Don't forget, President Lula was very often said, all the crises always began in our countries 25 years ago. Yeah. Why are all the crises now taking place in the developed industrial world?
Yeah, President Lula of Brazil. I wonder if you could explain how it is that they are doing so well after a global recession, not just the Brazilians, but the Chinese and the Indians, and the rest of us are still struggling.
I think in large part it's a matter of regulation. It's a matter of transparency. The United States went through a long period in beginning in 2000, 2001 of basically tearing up the regulatory framework that had been put into place. The Securities and Exchange Commission was hollowed out basically. Not much responsibility on the part of the private commercial banks. And the same thing happened in Europe where countries year after year overspent, undersaved, and then found themselves in a position where they had to be bailed out. The Brazilians, on the other hand, were fiscally responsible, as were the other BRIC countries.
Assuming the European Union is around next Thursday when the BRICS meet, will there be a joint statement at the end, do you think, that says we are going to go forward with this pledge of support?
My sense is that there will be a lot of backroom conversations between now and next Thursday. Clearly, the BRICS are going to be in touch with Mrs. Merkel's government. There will no doubt be conversation with other members of the European Union, the ECB, the European Central Bank. Who will do that is not clear yet. It may well be that we're not going to know until next week. The Chinese and the Brazilians are out in front. They may well be the ones that are going to take the lead in terms of bringing South Africa and India, and we don't know what the position of Russia is going to be.
Might next Thursday be too late?
It could be if indeed things go as badly as the markets seem to indicate they are going. But even if it is too late, it's a sign once again, you know, that the BRIC countries in various ways are beginning to arrive in terms of having to be listened to and indeed to be part of the dialogue and conversation moving forward.
Reardon Rouet directs the Western Hemisphere Program at the School of Advanced International Studies at Johns Hopkins. Professor, thank you.
You're welcome.
All those promises that Europe won't collapse, made for a buying spree on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Last month's auto sales were more than a little bit disappointing. They were down, I don't need to tell you. And Detroit, at least in the short term, looks to be slipping back into neutral. The sputtering economy provides the backdrop, then, for some closely watched contract talks between the United Auto Workers and the Big Three this week. A deal with General Motors, they're the lead company in negotiations this time around, may come as soon as tonight, as Marketplace's Sarah Gardner reports.
Negotiations between the UAW and automakers have never been a love fest, but labor expert Gary Chasen says this year might be the closest they've ever come to making nice.
There's less shouting at each other and there's more talking to each other.
First off, GM and Chrysler workers can't strike. They surrendered that right as part of the 2009 government bailout. Second, the union knows the economy stinks and workers don't want the blame for ruining the industry's recovery. And automakers, they have their own reasons for toning down the rhetoric.
The companies themselves are under intense scrutiny.
Kristen Gicek is with the Center for Automotive Research in Ann Arbor.
You know, they've taken government money to re-engineer their balance sheets and to reinvigorate their companies, and they can't really go do stupid things either.
G-Check says both sides have to prove they've learned their lesson from GM and Chrysler's bankruptcies. Automakers are already paying new workers half what the old-timers are getting. They're now pushing profit sharing and signing and performance bonuses instead of old-fashioned wage hikes,
where they would be measured on measures of productivity and quality and perhaps even personal behaviors like attendance.
Auto workers still could get a modest pay hike in exchange for concessions on health care and profit sharing. But whatever happens in Detroit won't stay in Detroit. Labor analysts expect other unionized companies to take a cue from these negotiations when their labor contracts expire. I'm Sarah Gardner for Marketplace.
Congress held the first of what could turn out to be many hearings on the now-defunct solar firm Solyndra today. The company declared bankruptcy last week, laid off more than 1,000 people. Solyndra, though, is now being investigated over how it got and how it used government-backed loans. At the time, the company was celebrated as the way forward in green technology and in innovation. But commentator David Frum says Solyndra's failure tells a different story about the role of the federal government in private business.
So, you're working in an administration, and you discover a company with a genius new green technology. The company promises, with just a little startup cash, we can produce a new product and generate hundreds of high-paying new green jobs. Excellent. Congratulations. Quit your administration job, join a venture capital firm, and find investors to back your discovery. If you're right, they and you will all get rich together. But here's what not to do. Delude yourself that government can play venture capital investor. It just can't. The fiasco at the Solyndra Solar Panel Company is only the latest manifestation of a problem that dates back to the 1970s and U.S. support for synthetic fuels. Government can contribute enormously to economic innovation by supporting basic scientific research. Government can support schools and universities to train future innovators. Government can mitigate recessions, suppress inflation, and otherwise keep the macroeconomy humming. There's lots of things the government can do. Playing venture capitalist is the thing it cannot do. A real venture capitalist has a single mission: earn a return. That mission is challenging enough, and venture capitalists often fail. A government venture capitalist faces multiple and often contradictory missions. Yes, government wants a positive return on its investment. It also wants to generate good jobs. And it also wants to help depressed regions. And it wants to do all this on a timeline tied to the election calendar. If the U.S. government hopes to discourage the use of oil, there's one powerful mechanism at hand: tax the stuff. Private actors will respond to the incentive. They will conserve and substitute and innovate all on their own. But when it comes time for investments in individual firms, back off and let Mr. Market do the job that he does best.
David Frum was a speechwriter for President George W. Bush. Today, he's the editor of Frum Forum. Coming up next week in this space, Robert Reich. Your views come to us whenever you like. Go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. Coming up, sharing your bike is not as easy as you'd think.
Basically, we're starting a new transit system overnight.
But first, let's do the numbers. German and French leaders renewed their promises to help Greece avoid default today. That calmed things down a little bit. The Dow Industrials rose 1.25%, about 140 points, ended at 11,246. The NASDAQ added 1.6%, 40 points, closed at 2572. The S&P 500 gained 15 points, that's 1.3%, finished at 1188. Economic bellwethers like General Electric gained ground. GE lit up about 2.5% today. Monsanto grew 3%. Home Depot expanded more than 2.5%. Dell logged a gain of 3.33%. The company is adding $5 billion to its stock buyback plan. Staples stapled on, 3.5%, get it, Staples, stapled on. The office supply source said it's going to buy back up to $1.5 billion worth of its stock. Food giant Conagra said it's going to shelve a multi-billion-dollar bid for Rawcorp Holdings if the store brand food maker didn't respond by Monday. Rawcorp keeps rebuffing the food giant Conagra. Shed 2.5% today. The 10-year T-note stood pretty much still, kept its yield at about 1.99%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. In Washington, the Labor Department releases a consumer price index for August. The Federal Reserve issues its monthly report on industrial production. And the Senate Committee on Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions discusses the future of employment for people with the most significant disabilities. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Financial Times reported today that Facebook is taking a look around the ups and downs of the stock market, didn't like at all what it saw, and decided to unfriend it. The company is apparently going to put off its initial public offering, long rumored to have been in the works for some time this year. In the meantime, something akin to Judgment Day is coming to your Facebook account. Your Facebook friends are going to be sorted into categories: close friends, family, marketplace colleagues, what have you. The idea being that users will sort their Facebook friends and tailor updates and pictures and posts to specific groups. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith explains why that sounds familiar.
New Yorker Sharon Pack is a very active Facebook user.
I have probably 1,200 friends on Facebook.
Not that they're all actually her friends.
The close-knit amount of friends that I have would probably range from like 50 to 60.
The problem for advertisers has been finding those 50 real friends in the pool of 1,200 Facebook friends. James Fowler studies social networks at UC San Diego.
If you know that your friends bought a certain kind of jeans, then that makes you much more likely to buy those jeans as well. And that's a much, much more accurate way of trying to identify the behavior of somebody rather than just their age or their ethnic background or, you know, what zip code they live in.
Social networks like Facebook offer advertisers unprecedented access to our circle of friends, as well as several hundred other people who don't influence us at all. Fowler says businesses have been searching for the Rosetta Stone that will help them tell the difference.
The $64 million question at this point is who are the people in your social network that matter?
A couple months ago, Google Plus came up with one solution. When you connect with someone, you have to slot them into a category or circle, things like work or friends. Facebook users have had that option since 2007, but almost no one took the trouble. Now Facebook is getting assertive, using predictive software to pre-sort your friends into categories like close friends, acquaintances, work. Users can modify the lists and create new ones. Matt Britton is the CEO of marketing firm Mr. Youth. He says the advertising possibilities are big.
So if you're selling office-related products, you know, I can target a user and their work friends. Or if it's, I'm selling university-branded apparel, I can sell a user and their school friends.
Facebook reportedly took in roughly $2 billion in advertising revenue last year. Britton says this service could mean even more ad dollars. In New York, and already experiencing friend category anxiety, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter.
We spent a lot of time last week on the broadcast talking about jobs, that thing the economy has to have before it really starts getting better. So the day after the president's big speech Thursday night, we spoke to three economists about where things go from here, where those jobs might come from. Steve Elfelt from Altoona, PA, said we missed the elephant in the room in that discussion, the impossibility, he says, of never-ending economic growth.
We only have so many potential consumers. They only need so much stuff. And we can only convert so much of our natural resources to supply that stuff. Nothing in any human or natural system grows forever in perpetuity, so is it rational to expect that from our economy?
Mitchell Hartman took us to a company that is hiring despite the recession, Benchmade Knives up in Oregon. Tony Davidson lives in Tuxedo, New York, and he wants us to run upbeat stories like that every single day.
You know, if we start hearing more positive hiring stories, that could become a self-fulfilling prophecy because, you know, the business owner that hears about another business owner doing well might say, well, maybe things are not as bad as it otherwise would seem to be, and I can afford to go out and hire, too.
Finally, my misadventures in hypermiling yesterday. Truck driver Paul Wood wrote from Panama City Beach, Florida, to say he's been hypermiling for years to the displeasure of others on the road.
I'll get physical signs. I'll also get the horn quite often. It's quite funny that oftentimes the people I offend happen to be the ones that display bumper stickers with Save the Earth type messages.
We prefer emails to physical signs. Please send them our way. Just go to marketplace.org and click on that link that says contact. How you think about the job market kind of depends on where you're coming from. First-time worker, been around for a while, maybe you're close to retirement. So we're going to hear this week from people of different generations and how they're dealing with finding a job. Today, the 20s.
My name is Sandra Morin, and I live in Chicago, Illinois. I am job searching currently. I graduated in 2005 and moved to Chicago, and the first job that I accepted was at the Notabart Nature Museum. And I didn't have the best relationship with the manager at the time, and there was no room for growth within the department I worked in, so I started seeking jobs elsewhere. One of the things that I have noticed is that when I do apply to jobs, often I'm applying to jobs that I am overqualified for, which may be one of the reasons I am not getting them. Another reason, I believe, is the fact that I've been unemployed for so long, and so my resume reads, the last time I had a job was September 2010. My father currently works and has worked at the same factory job for 35 years, and he wishes me luck. You know, he hopes that I do well.
Sandra Morin wrote to us through our Public Insight Network. You can join at publicinsightnetwork.org. Forget Priuses or light rail. The latest transportation craze in a lot of big American cities is the humble bicycle. Bike sharing, to be specific. Short-term, one-way bike rentals. Today, New York City announced it's going to have 10,000 bikes in place by next summer. Not that these kinds of programs are without their own traffic jams. Andrea Bernstein reports from the Transportation Nation Project at WNYC.
In New York today, the city's transportation commissioner, Jeanette Sadikan, couldn't have been happier.
So we are here today to announce that the wheels are officially in motion for New York's bike share program.
Sadikan says bike share can fill a gap in the transit system.
There are times where you can't find a cab or you can't find the bus, the subway's not going to work, and so it's perfect for those short trips from point A to point B.
When New York's system is fully in place next year, members will be able to take any bike anywhere. They won't have to make a reservation, they won't have to say where they're going, and they'll even be able to sign up for just one day.
And it's outside my office, outside my home, outside my meeting, outside where I went to get lunch. It's wonderful.
In Washington, D.C., commuter David Knight says he uses that city's year-old bike share all the time to get to work and for other trips.
Then I was across town and it wasn't raining, so I picked it up last minute.
That flexibility has made bike share unexpectedly popular in D.C. More than 70,000 tourists and other casual users signed up in the first year, dwarfing the 15,000 yearly members. That kind of impulse purchase has some unexpected consequences. Eric Gilliland of Alta Bike Share, which operates D.C. system, says its busiest hour ever was after last month's rare earthquake.
It was just impossible to get around any other way.
Cars and buses were at a standstill. Metro trains were full.
In the span of an hour, we pretty much emptied out everything in the downtown area, which all ended up flooding out to the neighborhoods.
That can be a problem even on a regular day. In D.C. in July, bike stations were empty 9,000 times. And there were 5,000 incidences where stations were completely full, so cyclists couldn't return their bikes. As a result, the bikes have to be loaded up on trucks and moved around. Almost every city that's tried bike share has experienced some version of that phenomenon. In London, suburbanites take the train partway and then bike for the rest of their trips. All the bikes end up in the center of town. In Barcelona, cyclists go downhill, but not up. Catherine Morancy of Montreal's École Polytechnique has analyzed the data. She says when it comes to distributing bikes around a city, crowds are just not perfect.
For instance, if there's a subway breakdown, you will have issues because there will be no more bikes and all these regular patterns will disappear. If it rains in the morning and it's sunny in the afternoon, then all the patterns change.
Officials say adding more bikes and more stations will help solve the problem. Chris Holden of D.C.'s Transportation Department says having too much demand is a good problem in a way.
Basically, we're starting a new transit system overnight, and that means all the infrastructure, all the service systems, and then all the staff.
That's what New York wants to do beginning mid-2012. Bike share systems are under consideration for San Francisco, Seattle, even L.A. In New York, I'm Andrea Bernstein for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, courtesy of the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and incidentally, bad news for the children of the Rizdahl household. No more crunchy peanut butter in their school lunches. The USDA says the drought in the South is going to cut the 2011 peanut harvest in this country 13%. J.M. Smucker, which makes Jif and by itself accounts for almost half the peanut butter market in this country, says prices are going to go up 30% by the end of the year. So I'm right, right? You got to figure creamy's cheaper than crunchy, fewer peanuts. I don't know. Somebody write and tell me I'm wrong. Anyway, that's it. We got to go. Marketplace from APM, American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose about 1.25%, 140 points. The NASDAQ added 1.6%, 40 points. The S&P 500 picked up 15 points, 1.3%. Bahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. You can tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for the latest in business and economic news. And coming up next time back here, a medical mecca comes to Michigan. Jobs, maybe not so much.
If the goal is to create jobs, there's some vacant space in downtown Detroit. Why don't we build some pyramids?
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Do hope you can join us for that tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.